and step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Off Stage and On the Air, performance number 659. I am Lisa Sheps. I am joined today by my co-host, Miss Nicole Shiro.
Hello!
You are listening to the two of us on KOOP, HD1, HD3, Hornsby, streaming live as we do on Wednesdays and Thursdays at koop.org. Please don't go away.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your
It is Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. On the show today, we have Jarrett Productions and their show, Lifespan of a Fact, and a new, in our ongoing series of longstanding theaters, a new theater. We're going to be talking to Rupert Reyes and Joanne Carayon Reyes of Teatro Vivo. And of course, we'll have lively discussions. Yeah, we're going to have just some discussions of the world of theater in New York, Chicago, Atlanta, and Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. We'll be right back.
And from the rib, which the Lord God had taken from Adam...
Actually, we're going to be back right now because we have a lot to do and not a whole bunch of time to do it in.
I had to go look at what you were playing. I cheated because that was Loving You.
That was from a show called Pendragon, which is another show around the King Arthur story. We've actually played stuff from Pendragon before. That was called Deo Gracias. And the reason why I played that is I would like to say gracias to all of the people that became members and gave to the radio station last week during our membership drive.
Very exciting.
Yeah, it was. I'm going to have to agree with you.
Cool people. Thank you, thank you, yep. And thank you.
Thank you all. I believe we either made or came close or exceeded our goal. One of those three things. But what is always true every Wednesday at 1 o'clock is that we thank Kim Simpson for his wonderful, International Folk Bazaar, another great, great show. Kim has been pre-recording. I'm looking forward to having him in the studio again so we can see him and say hello.
Yes. And, I have to tell you, I was jamming out. Do you know where he went this year? I missed where he was.
I didn't. I have to say, I only caught bits and pieces of it. We were chit-chatting in the lobby here at the office.
Check it out.
Yep. So we have a whole bunch of things to talk about and only a very short time to talk about them. So we're only going to get to a few.
Rapid fire.
Folks can catch up on the other stuff that we were going to talk about at offstageonair.com. There will be links. But the first thing we do have to talk about is a loss to the theater community. Tony Walton, scenic designer for years and years and years, passed away with more than 50 Broadway productions. As scenic designer...
That's a lot. Yep. To be scenic designing.
Scenic designer, costume designer, and directing, actually.
That's just bananas. What a career.
He worked a lot with people like Mike Nichols, Bob Fosse, Jerry Zaks. He won Tonys for Pippin, House of Blue Leaves, and Guys and Dolls.
I love House of Blue Leaves.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful thing about how he came up with the scenic design in his obituary. So I will allow people to read that for themselves. His final Broadway show was A Tale of Two Cities in 2008.
Interesting.
And people may or may not know that he was married to one Julie Andrews and has a child by her.
I was about to say, isn't he the Mr. Andrews or...
He is.
Was married to Julie. Yep.
And as a matter of fact, he also has illustrated the 12 children's books that Julie Andrews and Mrs. Walton Hamilton did.
Okay, and it's about, that's, I was like,
it's about,
okay.
It's about Dumpy the Dump Truck.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar?
I do know Dumpy the Dump Truck. I was like, didn't he work with her on the children's book? So yes, he was, I guess I just didn't realize he was the illustrator for that. That's so cool.
He did indeed. So I'm just looking at his IMDb page and it's crazy. There's so much stuff. I'm going to go through a few of them. He did I'm Not Rappaport. This is an reverse chronological order, but not all of them. I'm just going to do like a couple each page. He did Seussical, The Man Who Came to Dinner, 1776, Annie Get Your Gun, Steel Pier, which we're going to hear a little music from later.
Steel Pier.
Yeah, a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. A Grand Night for Singing, She Loves Me. Guys and Dolls, Four Baboons Adoring the Sun. I have to go out and read that one.
That's a good one.
6 Degrees of Separation. Jerome Robbins Broadway, which he did both the scenic and costume designs for, as well as Anything Goes. Leader of the Pack, Hurley Burley, The Real Thing, Chicago, Streamers. The Act with your friend,
that's Minnelli, and that was Scorsese's One Try and
yep.
Do a show.
Also did Pippin, and the last show, or the first show he did was called Apropos of Current Times, Once There Was a Russian, in February of 1961. It opened and closed on the same day. Scenic and costume design.
Interesting.
Okay, so I've got to kind of decide what I want to talk about in the next thing. I guess I kind of want to talk about The Bedwetter, which is coming to Off-Broadway. Are you familiar with The Bedwetter?
I've heard of it, but I'm not like super familiar, although there was a period in my time I was very familiar.
Well, this is from the memoir of Sarah Silverman. And it is starring Cassie Levy and Bebe Neuwirth. It's a musical.
I love Bebe.
It's got a book by Sarah Silverman and Joshua Harmon with music by Sarah Silverman and Adam Schlesinger. So looks like a lot of fun. It's going to open April 30th, running through June 19th at the Atlantic Theater Company. If I were in New York, I would go see that.
I agree with you, Miss Lisa Sheps.
Very quickly, I'm not going to even talk about this. I just want people to know about it in our last 2 minutes here. Daniel Radcliffe, we are going to talk about that. But, I closed it.
You
but
did
it's
it again.
Great Performances is doing...
Anything Goes,
and then there's another one that I wasn't familiar with, and then a documentary on Sondheim. That's on, I think, 3 consecutive Fridays or
and
Sundays.
And it's the Anything Goes with Sutton Foster.
Sutton Foster, correct.
That she did in England, two years ago.
We call it the West End here in the business.
The West End, yes.
And the final thing I want to talk about is this new off-Broadway production of Merrily We Roll Along, starring Daniel.
Exciting.
Starring one Daniel Radcliffe and directed by Maria Friedman for the New York Theater.
I'm so excited. And I saw it and I thought of you instantly, Lisa.
You thought of me?
Yes, it was so funny. I was like, Lisa, I don't know why I thought of you, because normally I think of Anne Shkreli in those Sondheim-y shows.
Oh, interesting.
Well, I feel like you are fascinated with this one show.
Well, I can't say I'm fascinated with it, but it's
intrigued?
Near to me because the show I did and Merrily We opened and flopped at the same time. Ran for a week. We ran for 2 days. But this is a Sondheim musical. It ran for a week. It was considered a big flop at the time. And now it's got a huge following of people that love it. And it's
done. Music in it. Woo!
Music is great. And it's done chronologically backwards.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
And what's his name is doing a film chronologically backwards over 10 years.
Oh, yeah. What's his name?
I forgot his name.
I forgot his name too. Yeah. I can see his face.
Well, people can look it up on the
what's his name?
The Googles. Real quick, we don't really have time to talk about it. But one of the things that I think is interesting to talk about is Mary Badham, who played Scout in the movie of To Kill a Mockingbird, is now going to be on the Broadway tour, hopefully coming through Austin. Is it coming through Austin?
I don't know. You'll have to find out.
I'll have to find out. But she's playing Mrs.
See who else was in it too, but I love this story.
She's playing Mrs. DuBose, in who is the Scout's mean morphine addicted neighbor.
I was about to say the mean morphine addicted neighbor.
The mean one, Mr. Grinch.
Yes. Did you see who else was starring in it? Richard Thomas.
Yeah, I did. Well, he's doing it on Broadway. I didn't know he was going to go on the road with it. Is he going on the road?
Yeah, they announced he's going on the road for a bit. I was like, oh, interesting.
Well, we love our Richard Thomas, John Boy.
I saw that yesterday and was like, I knew about Scout, but what is this John Boy?
There you go. Well, we've completely run out of time. So you can see all the other things we were thinking about talking about at offstageonair.com. We need to go to our first break and come back with Jarrett Productions. So let's listen to a little bit of Steel Pier, First You Dream, which was scenic design by Tony Walton. Here it is.
First you dream about incredible things.
Well, sitting here with me in the Zoom room, it's a full crowd here, folks. I'm very excited. Lifespan of a Fact is opening tomorrow, and we have the whole Jarrett team here with us, basically. We do have the entire cast, and we are fortunate enough to have the playwrights. And I will welcome David Jarrett, who's the director and the founder and artistic director of Jarrett Productions. Welcome back, David.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Always a pleasure to be here.
And the three actors, Carlo Garcia. Welcome back, Carlo.
Hey, everybody.
Will Douglas. Hi, Will.
Hello, Lisa.
And Janelle Buchanan. Hi.
Hi. Glad to be here.
And super excited to be welcoming the playwrights of this incredible piece, which I saw on Broadway several seasons ago. Jeremy Carrican. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello. I
do fine. I do just fine. Thank you. And David Morrell. He waved, which doesn't always work on radio, but in this case it did.
Look at my hand.
So, Lifespan of Effect. Well, normally I would ask the producer and director what this show is all about, but I think maybe I'll take this opportunity to ask one of the playwrights. Tell us about this show.
This was a play that was that is a fight between a fact checker and an author, refereed by an editor. And it is the story of an author who's written a moving and powerful piece about a suicide of a teen in Las Vegas, Nevada, and probably both the best and the worst possible fact checker in the world. Someone who is able to, you know, question granular details all the way to the question of our existence. It's primarily a comedy with some very serious moments in it.
David, tell me why this play, why now?
We read the book when it was published in 2012. I don't know, some of your audience may remember it. It was very widely reviewed. It was a controversial book. It sold well, but it was also very controversial because people were passionate about either hating the essayist, the author, or being on his side. So it got a lot of attention in organs like, you know, the New Republic and the New Yorker and Harper's and the Atlantic, you know, places like that. And it also, the proceeds of it go to suicide charities. So it's not only a great book, it's also a good cause. And it's really terrific and funny. The typography of it is interesting because the entire book is written simply as a dialogue, almost like a play, where it's like the fact checker, Jim, is on one side of the page and the essayist, John, is on the other side of the page. And they're just talking back and forth. So we read it and it was really a no-brainer that, oh my God, this book is practically a play already.
David Jarrett, I'm going to ask you the same question for you. Why for Jarrett Productions this play and why do it right now in Austin?
Well, as I have with several of the plays that we've produced in the past, I was inclined to like the play before I saw it. I read about it. I heard about it. And then when I did see the show, I thought, yes, this is definitely something that's in our wheelhouse. And I probably pestered Jeremy a lot during 2019 as they were searching for a publisher for the play because I wanted to make sure we got the rights to the play. So we have actually had the rights to this play since 2019. And the overall broad themes of the play, truth versus accuracy, how negotiable is a fact, the complexities of facts. It's a universal kind of a thing. The times that we're living in now seem to put exclamation points behind all of those ideas because there are so many facts that seem malleable. And maybe some of them should. So,
well, I mean, I personally use alternative facts.
Well, we are well aware of alternative facts over the past 4 or 5 years, if you know what I mean. So I think that it's going to be well-timed and we will actually be back in front of live audience for the first time. As a matter of fact, tomorrow when we open on the 10th is exactly 2 years from the day we shut down rehearsals of the play that we were about to open in the spring of 2020.
I want to talk to the cast. I know you've got a little scene that we're going to play for you. But Carlo, tell me about the role of John. Yeah, that's it. That's the end of the question.
Tell you about the role of John. So John DeGatta is the essayist who has written this beautiful piece about this teenager who has ended his life. And it's a very beautiful piece that's filled with poetry. But he is given a fact checker who is checking all of the facts, literally every single one. And it causes a lot of tension and drama between the two characters, as well as the editor played by Janelle.
Will, you're playing Jim, the fact checker in question. Can you tell us about that character?
I sure can. Jim is a young, ambitious person with a very analytical brain. One of my favorite parts about this script are the debates between John and Jim, which are at the center of the piece. But Jim is so interestingly kind of unable to understand the poetry all the time. Because he just has to see the facts of the piece and the minutiae of the details that may or may not be, you know, a little flubbed here and there or nudged here and there. But yeah, I think I just find it so fascinating, the question of, you know, is a fact truly what truth is based on? is like the very exact fact what truth is, or is there more to it than that?
You're bringing up an interesting point that I wanted to ask, that I sometimes like to ask actors who do Jim Tringle. Do you think it's the course of events of the play that cause him to be as rigorous as he is, or is he just like that?
Yeah, not to do the cop-out answer, but I think it's a little bit of both. I think his brain is very different than John's. I think he just thinks things a little differently. I think he's incapable a little bit of kind of the more poetic, abstract thought. But I do think a lot of it in the play, I think a lot of it comes out from his ambition, like the drive to just do a really good job.
And Janelle, tell us about Emily. That's the editor from forgot whether it was a magazine, newspaper, or what kind of media outlet it was.
The unnamed magazine which I assume we can think is a Harper's or Atlantic, something like that. She's been with the magazine, as she says, for who knows how long. She is very proud of the magazine and she considers it her magazine. She really, really, really wants this John DeGatta piece. She's worked with him before, she likes him. She knows he does tend to take a few liberties once in a while, but she thinks she's got a slam dunk here, and this will be her legacy piece. And then here comes Jim Fingal, and he really upsets the apple cart.
I know we have a piece and we're going to play it for you right now. David, do you want to set it up for the audience?
We've kind of telescoped a couple of scenes, one between Emily and Jim as she puts Jim in contact with John, and then a phone call that John has with Jim early in the show.
You know what? You should check all this with John.
You mean like talk to him?
Email him. Introduce yourself. He's passionate about his work, but he always has time for people who are polite and intelligent. And you're polite and intelligent. Right? Are you?
Of course.
So I'll send you his contact info. Clear up whatever you have a question about.
Okay, I think I can do that.
But stick to the facts. Don't change anything with regard to the shape and intent of the piece.
Stick to the facts. Got it.
Is this Jim Fingle?
Yes, this is Jim Fingle.
Why are you doing this?
Excuse me?
Why are you doing this?
It's my job.
Yes, but why?
Because Emily Penrose told me you take the occasional liberty.
I take liberty with things that deepen the central truth of the piece. Don't get bogged down in the details, because that's my job.
I understand that, but how many strip clubs, and can you tell me where you got the information?
I used Adult Industry News.
And that's a problem, because the magazine is confusing.
Yeah, it is. So I picked 34 because I liked the rhythm.
You liked the rhythm?
That was a great scene. Thank you for sharing that with us. I should tell our audience that Nicole Shiro has snuck in here while we were in the middle of the interview. So I just want to acknowledge that she's here with us in the room so that she knows that she can ask questions if she likes. Although we're almost out of time, tell us, when are you doing the show? When does it open? Where are you doing it? How can people get more information?
We open tomorrow, March 10th, at the Ground Floor Theater. We have a very limited engagement, only 8 performances between March 10th and the 19th. All of the performances in the evenings are at 7:30. We have one Sunday matinee on the 13th at 2:30. We have an ASL interpreted performance on Saturday, the 12th, and all of the information may be found at our website, jarrettproductions.com.
Right, you got everything. So I must say, I'm really happy that you're doing the Sunday matinee at the dentist's favorite time. So that's important.
The dentist's favorite time?
2:30.
2:30. Oh.
Got it.
I know. I'm the queen of dad jokes. I have them all.
And you're welcome. You're welcome. For that one, you're right? Welcome. You're welcome for me setting you up.
So I, you know, it's not often that we get the playwrights on of a show that is of this renown. So I just wanted to give David or Jeremy a chance to like impart anything to our Austin audiences that might be coming to the show that you'd like to say.
Well, we're just grateful to anyone who shows up for the show, because over the last couple of years as theater professionals, we have felt, as all of you have, the enormous dearth in our culture as a result of theater being absent. And it has really driven home to us in a way that might have been intellectual prior to lockdown, but with lockdown, we really see that theater is an essential human activity, and we are not human beings without theater. And we thank anyone who's interested in it and wants to go see our show or any other show.
I'm in complete agreement with that. I got to the first play that I got to see after all this had occurred, I just was smiling for 2 days, and I got to see people on stage again, interact and be alive and be together. And that's what life is about. And I'm happy that you're all involved in it in Austin, and it's a great theater town, and we hope you enjoy it.
Wonderful. Thank you. David Morrell, I have to tell you that the sentiments that you expounded are something that we're really familiar with. I haven't quite heard it so directly as "we are not humans without theater." I am going to steal that.
Loved it.
So thank you. Well, wonderful. Well, I thank you all for joining us on Offstage and on the air. And hopefully we'll be together live in the studio pretty soon.
You see this tree? It is a fir tree. It's called a fir tree because it gives us fur for coats. It also gives us wool in the wintertime.
I never knew that before, Lucy. That's
okay, those are alternative facts.
Alternative facts.
So that little piece of music that I cut out way earlier than I wanted to is from Charlie Brown, and it's the little known facts, because, you know.
I, I was wondering if that's what that was, and I was like, that's really
It's lifespan of a fact. So again, we just have a couple of minutes, so I just want to tell folks that City Theater is producing Ideal Husband over at Trinity Street Playhouse, and it opens in a short little while. I got to see if I have it open here on my computer so I could tell you when it was.
I think it's open right now, and it runs a little bit. The Ideal Husband?
The Ideal Husband is open. It's running through March 13th.
Dun, 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 dun.
You are correct. So let's just go straight into Today in Theater History.
All right. What happened, Lisa?
We're going to zip through this. In 1922, Eugene O'Neill's Hairy Ape opened at Provincetown.
That's 100 years ago.
Yeah, at Provincetown Playhouse, which is where he did most of his work.
Mm-hmm.
In 1959, I was 1 year old. Mark Blitzstein adapted Juno and the Paycock as a musical called Juno. It opened at the Winter Garden Theater, starring Shirley Booth and Melvin Douglas. Shirley Booth, of course, was Hazel. It only ran for 16 performances, and we're going to hear a little bit of that music.
Interesting!
1989, The Heidi Chronicles by Wendy Wasserman opened at the Plymouth.
Oh, yeah.
It won the Pulitzer, and it starred Joan Allen. In 2008... In the Heights, which was playing off Broadway, opened at the Richard Rogers Theater, starring Mandy Gonzalez, Karen Olivo, Priscilla Lopez, and of course, Lin-Manuel Miranda. And then
my Christopher Jackson, and I.
Yeah. He is yours. And this is a show that I was just talking to someone about yesterday, not in a good way, but in 2010, Andrew Lloyd Webber's Love Never Dies, the sequel to The Phantom, opened at the Adelphi Theater on the West End. Didn't do very good, but it starred Ramin Karimloo and Sierra Bogus.
Wasn't it on the tour not too long ago?
It was on tour, yes. Mm-hmm. Indeed,
it
indeed.
It never dies.
Indeed. In 2020, the Connor McPherson Bob Dylan musical, Girl from the North Country, opened at the Belasco.
I forgot about the Bob Dylan musical. Did I?
This is the birthday of Raul Julia.
Oh!
Who one would think he might, in today's day and age, he would change the pronunciation of his last name to Julia, but that's just me. Joyce Van Patten. Lonnie Price and Juliette Binoche.
That's an interesting group of people. Miss Raul.
You miss who?
I miss Raul Julia.
Did he pass?
Yes.
Jeez, how long ago did he pass away?
A long time ago. There's that great documentary on him great performances plays. Oh. Here and there. Gosh, 90s, 94, 95.
I should check it out.
I think it's called I Am Raul, if I remember correctly.
That would be an apt name for it.
They have him doing Shakespeare in the Park with Meryl Streep and Meatloaf.
Yeah.
In it.
All that is good except for the Shakespeare part. For me. Okay, well, that's it. We need to take another break. We're going to hear a little bit of Bird Upon a Tree from Juno, which starred Shirley Booth. I think she sings this, but I think it starts with the male voice, so we may not get to her sound. But anyway, and I'm going to say goodbye to Nicole Shiro till next week.
Au revoir, Lisa Schatz.
Au revoir, Nicole Shiro.
We learn what is happening in the world of theater on offstage and on the air.
There you go. And here is Bird Upon a Tree. We'll be right back.
There was a bird upon a tree. Its foot was caught.
I'm so thrilled to have the founders of Teatro Vivo here on the phone with me, Rupert Reyes and Joanne Carrion Reyes. Welcome to Offstage and on the Air.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's just start at the very beginning of Teatro Vivo. When what year did it start?
We started in the year 2000. We did our first production actually at McCallum High School when our son actually was at school there, and so our daughter too. And so we produced our first show there in May of 2000. I remember it was over Mother's Day, and we offered a Mother's Day special. Bring your mom in free.
Bring your mom, you come in free. Well, let's talk about why you started Teatro Viva. What was the impetus to get going?
Well, we were actually on the board of a group called Teatro Humanidad Pensada, which actually changed the name later to just Humanidad. And we had produced a show at the Paramount. It was very successful. I think it was Latin Anonymous, and really almost sold out the Paramount. And the board thought, wow, we can keep doing this. And we said, no, we've got a little bit more experience in theater, and we don't want to be working on booking 1,200-seat houses. We'd like to stay small. And so at that moment, really, there was, like I said, more of, I would say, an artistic difference in of the direction of the company. And so really was an idea, the idea of keeping small and bringing shows that were original scripts. They also wanted to continue to do existing plays, which we felt as theater artists, especially theater artists of color, that we needed to promote new work, new playwrights. And so that was kind of the direction Teatro Vivo took. And we broke off and formed Teatro Vivo in 2000 to continue to produce small plays, which, again, we still continue to play small houses and try to specialize in new works.
What was the environment like for Latinx theater back then?
Well, there wasn't much of it, first of all. So it was our company and Teatro Humanidad who did, you know, they took another path, but didn't really do more shows at the Paramount. So we continued to try and live within what was an existing vibe with, you know, the Off Center, with Salvage Vanguard, with, you know, the DAC, which it was a different environment, as Rupert, you know, tried to describe. It wasn't as complex as it is today. We were very much into connecting with communities, connecting with organizations, connecting, even though we're not religious at all, there's a lot of Latinos that go to churches. So we would do a lot of publicity, actually papering cars at churches, a lot of grassroots type stuff, because what we were finding was people didn't know about Latino theater. They didn't know about bilingual theater. They were not, a lot of the people we were attempting to reach with our shows were just not familiar with theater in general. And so we had to do a lot of just, like I said, grassroots publicity. And also back then, if we're in the past, there was actually local radio stations where we could come on and do pitches, and that no longer exists. There's no longer, they're all syndicated kind of radio.
Yeah, they were radio stations that were owned by families. I mean, there was like a family that owned a radio station. There was KELG in Elgin. I know there was one in Round Rock.
So we just started reaching out to community organizations. I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of community centers. I think, though, it was, you know, as to a certain extent, it's this way now anyway, is that word of mouth was our biggest publicity. Once we did one show, it was like people brought their family, their tías, their abuelitas, and it was like something they had never seen before locally in Austin. So we enjoyed that a lot. We really got to know our audiences. There were people that I saw only as audience members who felt like we were old, friends. Mm-hmm. And so we garnered quite an audience that way. And it was lovely.
Well, you know, and the wonderful thing about when we started performing and doing shows, the first shows we did were some of the scripts that I wrote, and a series of plays based on a family, Petra Dominguez and her family along the border, called Petra's Pecado, Petra's Sueño, Petra's Cuento. And people would not want to leave the theater. After the show would close, they really want to just come and visit with each other or stuff. And so that was one of the things why we introduced talkbacks. We would do talkbacks after every play and sit and have a conversation with the audience. And they didn't, it was interesting because they didn't see, for them, theater, it sometimes was more like a movie. It was not unusual for our actors to be asked for autographs after our plays. for audience members to stand outside wanting autographs on their programs from the actors. That was kind of sweet and warm.
That's amazing. Tell me a little bit about, and we're going to get back into Teatro Vivo specifically, but tell me a little bit about the two of you and your background. Were you always in theater? Did you study theater here? How did you find your way into theater and then running a theater?
I was a theater education major. I was graduated from University of Texas with a degree in theater education. I did not discover Chicano theater until about my third year in college. And I watched this play and I was just totally amazed that here were brown people speaking bilingually, telling Chicano stories that I had never seen on the stage. I mean, as a theater major, I was being introduced to all the classics, Shakespeare and you know, all the realism and all these plays. And none of them looked like me and none of them spoke like me. Well, about a year later, Jorge Huerta, who is Dr. Jorge Huerta, was finishing up his PhD, came to lecture at, the Chicano Theater Committee had brought him in to give a lecture. And he spoke about the Chicano theater movement. All over the country, there were these small theater companies doing political theater and had formed an organization called TENAZ, which held annual festivals in all over the U.S. and in Mexico. And I listened to that, and we sat and talked to him after the lecture. We must have stayed there till 2 a.m. talking to him. And by the time he left, a group of us decided we were going to form our own theater company called the Teatro Lágrimas y Risas, is what it was called. Tears and Laughter.
Yeah, I was not a theater major. I was dabbled in theater in high school and, you know, loved the theater, but I was an education major and I was very much involved with the student movement, the Chicano student movement on campus. And so, you know, there was a lot of that blended for me in, you know, social justice issues, et cetera. So that was my draw into doing this kind of theater.
Teatro Vivo was born in 2000 and your first show was at McCallum High School. Do you remember what show that was?
Yeah, it was called Petra's Cuento. It was one of the second in the series of Petra plays that I'd written. And it's it uses the Llorona.
Did you remember how successful that was? Were there a lot of people that came to see it?
Oh, yeah. The theater that at the McCallum High School, the old theater, I think sat 300 people. And we sold that theater out. We did 8 shows, and I think we sold it out almost at 6 of the 8. And one of the reasons also was because we Jim Swift, I don't know if you know, remember Jim Swift. Have you ever heard of Jim Swift? He used to do little profiles on one of the local TV stations. And he did one called On the Back Porch. And so he came and profiled that performance and talked about bilingual theater. And so did little clips of that. So that was also another big publicity thing for us. We got a real good PR push on that show.
Wonderful. Well, I'm curious. So, you know, language and what we call things is so fraught these days. And I noticed that you've been talking a lot about Chicano theater. Do you still use that term for the work that Teatro Vivo does? Or did you in your tenure, were you calling it Chicano theater or Latino theater? What was the name for it back then?
Well, we called it Latino theater. Chicano. While I'm not opposed to not using that word, I don't mind it at all. I think it's a great word. At that time, it described a movement of theater, a style of theater that directly related to a lot of the farm worker and issues and stuff. And our plays, excuse me, were a little bit broader than that. I think that we kind of moved away from a lot of the farm worker movement, even though I know it's still kind of, they still struggle, but to more different kind of issues. So Latino bilingual theater is what we started calling it.
I think, you know, the kind of the agitprop, the really didactic theater, was still in, you know, we still had roots in it, but there was this kind of a determination that a lot of those theater companies made back in the day that said, we're going to focus more on our art, becoming better directors, better writers, better actors. And it's in that way that we'll have a greater impact rather than really pushing the politics like front and center, hit them over the head with the politics kind of thing. And so there was a purposeful move towards developing artists. And in telling the stories of the characters, like in Petra's Pecado, we are kind of helping people to understand who are not part of the culture, to maybe have a window into the culture, and for people who are of the culture to feel like they're represented on stage.
And thus was born Teatro Vivo. I'm curious, when you started, after you did that first show, at what point did you formally organize the theater? Whether, you know, when did you create the business of Teatro Vivo?
It took us about 4 years. It wasn't until like 2004. We were just being, we had sponsors, you know, fiscal sponsors in the community. And then our structure was, I mean, because it was pretty much myself and Rupert. And we had no other employees. We had volunteers. We had people that were kind of company members. And so it was very, very much that kind of grassroots. I feel like we were mom and pop to a lot of actors of color here in Austin, and kind of continue to be mom and pop to them. So Rupert handled all the artistic. He was the artistic director, and he used to like to say he handles everything behind the curtain, and I handled everything in front of the curtain. So I was the one that booked the venues, did the publicity, did the box office, greeted the audiences, did the welcoming speech, you know, with the help of volunteers. I don't mean to sound like I did everything, but, you know, pretty much the buck stopped here. And Rupert, you know, did a lot of the directing.
Yeah, well, when the curtain opened, my job was to have a play behind that curtain and ready to go for the audience, because Joanne was going to have the audience. Also, one thing that I'm very proud of is from day one, we've paid our actors. We have never asked our actors to work for free. And it, of course, we're not paying them huge amounts of money, but our values, our principles were that the artists are workers. And I know that, that what we use a lot in the California term, you don't hear very much, but they're cultural workers. And so we've always paid our actors. It was just, we were very fortunate. But we've also worked in a very familia kind of way. We made a point of always, you know, telling people that if you're not having fun working with us, please let us know. We're not paying everybody enough to endure hardships. And we would always have what we call traditionally the cena. And the cena was a supper that we would have. Rehearsals would start on Monday for the next production. We would have everyone involved in the production. We're invited to come and share a meal and introduce each other. Everybody introduced themselves and told what role they were playing in this production, because we had this also the same belief that every single person involved in the show is important for the success of that show. There's no one person that is responsible for the whole thing. It really is a collaborative effort.
Which is true. And I think it's wonderful that you've been paying actors from the get-go. And I guess our audience should, if you're not aware, I mean, people listening to this might go, well, of course you're going to pay your actors. But in our industry, oftentimes the actors are the only ones that are working for free. And it's quite unconscionable, if you ask me, to ask that of workers. And so we may not be paying you know, nobody's going to retire on what we're paying, but at least we're paying people. So I want to acknowledge that in the year 2000, that probably wasn't done all that much, especially at the community level. Are any of those people that you were working with then, are they still part of the Teatro Vivo family, actively working with Teatro Vivo?
No, I would say that from our group, a lot of people have moved out of Austin. People like, I know some people that had some early connections with us that were not working with us, but also had some contact with us and were part of the same community. People like Roxanne Schroeder Arce, who is now on the board, was one of those people. She's been around Austin for a while. Oscar, who is also on the board now,
Oscar Frankel became a
volunteer early on when he got to Austin. I think he graduated from UT, right? And started working with Teatro, and now is also on the board.
Let me ask, you were producing, you produced your first work at McCallum. When did you move away from McCallum? Did you continue to produce at McCallum? And then you had mentioned the Off-Center, and of course, Salvage Vanguard didn't show up until probably around 2006, 2007. Of course, now we have Mexicarte, and we have the DAC, and we have these city venues. Where are some of the venues that you ended up going to?
We did lots of shows at the Dougherty. that was our kind of our home base for a while. Mainly there, we did do a show at Johnston High School. It's interesting because the connection back then to high schools was if you knew the theater teacher, you could use the theater. It's not that way anymore. It's totally, you know, regulated by the school district. You know,
yeah, but we did get, but the, just to be sure that people know this, that the Dowdy, they had a very good process of selecting plays.
Yeah, that's true.
So you already had your booking at the Dowdy, and they usually relate. We usually could get two shows there a year, and then we have to find a venue somewhere else.
So that's amazing. So the Dowdy actually was curating their work back then, which they don't do now.
No, it was great because then they would also produce a quarterly mail out, a newsletter that would include what was going to be happening in the next 3 months, what the performances were going to be, descriptions and things like that. So they would create a season. It was almost a season that was there.
What are some of the challenges that you, I mean, the way you talk about this, and I know as someone who runs a theater myself, getting audiences has been a challenge. Our demographic is probably a little bit more of the mainstream. So if there had Have there been challenges for you? It sounds like you were selling out a 300-seat house in the year 2000, which is amazing. Have you been having challenge building an audience, or what are some of the other challenges to producing bilingual theater in Austin?
I think the challenge was when we went to the Long Center. Back then, Cliff Redd was the director of the Long Center, and he welcomed us with open arms. We had access to the Rollins Theater. We had access to fee support to pay for it. The challenges was getting our audiences there because they were used to coming to the Dougherty or somewhere on the east side. Some people welcomed it, thought it was big and fancy and wonderful, and other people thought, this is a little bit highfalutin for me. I don't know if I can afford to pay for the parking, let alone the ticketing. So that was challenging, was ticket prices. But one of the things that we always insisted on was having one night that is a pay what you wish night. And that was a tradition in our company. And that was to give access to people that we thought couldn't afford whatever ticket price we had to charge to get there.
You know, and there was no challenge to producing bilingual theater. I mean, the play was not the issue. In fact, I would say that we were really thrilled that I would say half of our audiences were monolingual English speakers. We and most of our support, I mean, honestly, came from Anglos. They would be the highest donors. They would help contribute to it when we do fundraisers. The issue, like I said, Joanne talked about venues, and I'm going to probably put my foot in my mouth right now, but I'm going to say it just because I feel very strongly about it, and that is the Mexican-American Culture Center is a place that should be home to all Latino artists. Unfortunately, the city of Austin has made it so cumbersome to get a contract there, to operate there, that is not a welcoming place anymore.
Sure. I mean, we have a community have been talking about that because that also affects the DAC, the Carver, the Asian American Cultural Center. All those venues are under the auspices of the city. And as we look forward to new venues with government and private partnerships, we're making sure that we don't have that same situation, that if it's going to be. So, for instance, in my opinion, and I'll go ahead and throw my foot in my mouth too, Rupert, is that Teatro Vivo should be given the responsibility and the privilege of running the MAC. And that would be a much more sane way to run a theater.
I agree. I agree. I think, again, you know, the at one time that it existed. Now, suddenly we have there's staff shortages. But if you go to these centers, there's staff there all day long and 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, who does theater at 9 o'clock in the morning?
We actually want to talk about your theater. So let's jump back into Teatro Vivo. How many shows in those first 5 or so years, how many shows did you do in a season?
We would do a show in the spring, a show in the summer, and then we would do a collaboration of the Pasarela. For a long time, Palas Pasarela was a collaboration between all the Latino groups, both visual and performing groups, for a long time, under the auspices of a thing called ALTA, Austin Latino Theater Alliance. And so, and then eventually that ended up kind of falling apart. And so we took on the Paso de la. Teatro Vivo has been doing the Paso de la for a while. But, and then about 10 years ago, we decided that it was time that we had a local new play festival. And so Austin Latino New Play Festival was called, I think it's now called Latinx Play Festival. But
so you did about four shows per season. So tell me about Alta. I'm assuming it doesn't exist anymore. And who was behind that?
Well, what happened was the Pasarela was produced at the old MAC. The old MAC, I don't know if people realize, before the MAC, that beautiful building that sits there on that site now, was a Street and Bridges, City of Austin Street and Bridges facility with a big, huge warehouse to roll those big trucks in to repair. Well, that was the stage. That became the stage. And so the only plays that were done there, as a matter of fact, were the Pasarela. It was done there every year. Well, the city came and raised it with the idea that they were going to build a MAC there. So there was between the time that they tore it down and they started constructing, the Pastorella ceased to exist because it didn't have a venue. And about two or three years went by with no Pastorella. And then one day, a group of people, like just casual conversation, started talking about how to revive it. Well, nobody really had the capacity to do a play. There was no, other than Teatro Vivo, there was no theater company in Teatro Humanidad. That really wanted to take on that responsibility. And so we called for a meeting and like I said, we had visual artists there, we had musicians, we had the theater companies and dance companies that all came together and we applied for a City of Austin cultural contract grant. We got like $5,000 and produced it under the title of Austin Latino Theater Alliance and became known as ALTA. So ALTA continued to go and it started floundering, started kind of sputtering it out and eventually it just stopped. And in that void, Teatro Vivo said, look, we're not going to let the Pasarela stop. We'll take on the Pasarela now. We're capable of doing that.
So that group Alta started basically to produce Pasarela, and now you guys are doing it. So you guys have left Teatro Vivo. When did that happen?
The transition happened in 2016-2017. We continued to, be a guide on the side, so to speak, whenever needed, but that's when it happened. And so the board has continued to basically run as a board of directors that helps produce projects. So currently that's the system now. They are, of course, the hope is to get a full-time artistic director.
So you guys sound like you have retired from Teatro Vivo and yet not all at the same time. Because it's your baby and I understand it. Well, wonderful. I really appreciate you guys talking to me and letting me know how things go. I'm going to hope to get Oscar Franco to maybe talk to him more about what's going on now and what the future plans are. But Joanne and Rupert, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Latins, they don't play baseball. They are not so good with a rake or a...
Okay, well, that was Rupert Reyes and Joanne Carrion Reyes of Teatro Vivo. Next week, we'll finish up with... oh, my God. Forgot his first name, Oscar Franco, who is currently the chair of the board and running Teatro Vivo right now. And I'm talking to the folks over at, Spectrum and Pro Arts Collective about being our next victims on our long-going segments on long-standing theaters. And Pro Arts Collective, of course, as you know, was founded by Boyd Vance and others, and we will hopefully get an idea, which then led to Spectrum. So we're so looking forward to that. Once again, thank you so much for supporting Co-op Radio and Community Radio here in Austin, Texas. So that during the last week and during our membership drive, we really, really look forward to that. Another little piece of news that we didn't talk about earlier, but is interest to some, that, you know, the world is changing. Mask mandates and things like that are going away. And in New York State, in New York City, the mask mandates went away. But the Broadway League, doing something good, is saying no. The Broadway shows will continue their mask mandates and their vaccine
proof of vaccination status until at least the end of April. So good for them for erring on the side of being more careful. Well, this has been a great show. We have a Texas Music Mixtape coming up. We got DJ Mark is chomping at the bit. He's standing here. I can hardly keep him away from the microphone. It's really difficult to keep him away from the microphone because he's so darn good at it. That is coming up next. Remember, you can get information on our show at offstageonair.com. And with that, I'm going to say goodbye to you, and we'll see you next week when we look at what's happening offstage and on the air. Bye, everybody.
Latins, they don't like farming. You seldom see Latins milking a cow.